Everybody got quiet. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
As you can see, I am not Larry Hogan. But as we start, I would like to call up Keith Tobias. We have a couple of customer service awards. And maybe I should have asked for your comments first, but let's get the customer service awards taken care of.
Thank you very much. I'm Keith Tobias with the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, soon to be the Department of Health. And we just want to recognize Christine Farley from the Board of Physicians and Audrey Clark from the Office of Controlled Substance Administration. And through the governor's initiative and part of the customer service promise, we got feedback from a physician's assistant who was complaining and suggesting how we could improve things. And when we spoke to him, what he said made perfect sense to me, but I don't know if it would make sense to them. But they considered it honestly, and they pursued it and found ways to improve data integrity, speed the process for licensure, and that's been a jumping point for further collaboration between the two parts of department.
Very good. Can we hear a little bit more in terms of, was it an application process that you automated? What was actually the steps?
You want to
go first? It actually was. It was an application process where a different division needed a document from our office. And we were able to, rather than do a quarterly report, we didn't realize that they were needing that document. So now we're trying to do it in real time so that applicants don't have to worry about that document, that the agencies can handle it for them.
What we primarily wanted to do was make it a seamless process for the registrant who has to get the professional license from the Board of Physicians and then from us, the Controlled Dangerous Substance Permit, to write prescriptions for controlled dangerous substances, and, of course, that includes opioids. And Christine and I, even though we worked very closely together, there was still that gap that we were not aware of, that we had this time delay in getting this information for the prescriptive authority for the physician assistant to write prescriptions. And therefore, we just closed the gap, and Christine even took it a step further where she could automate that prescriptive authority, and that is now underway on her website where our licensing specialists can go to their website, click on prescriptive authority, and see it in real time. So we made it work for the customer, making it seamless.
Very good.
And the benefit was the feedback from the customer.
Mm-hmm.
If he hadn't pointed out that there was a gap, we kind of just would have done business as usual. So it presented an excellent opportunity to change things and make the application process more efficient.
Okay. Well, very good.
Can I ask a question? Since you're the expert, it was great you had someone who called the customer. Is there a way to... in real time, in your office, now that you're aware of this sort of thing, but perhaps not every specific example, how would you go about yourselves testing it to see whether there are other places that this sort of thing can be done?
Well, I know our board is trying to work, and DHMH, or Department of Public Health, in July 1st, they're really making strides toward efficiency and communication among the different units. And I know Audrey is trying to automate, and we are trying to all pull together so that there is that communication among the different units.
So this can be a great one-time experience, but also a lesson learned.
Definitely.
Yeah. I hope it's going up the chain with the secretary so that they can look at different areas where we still have items that are in paper form, particularly where their registration, we're in a modern world where you can do a lot of things online, and in some cases there's, the autofill in that they can submit this information. I know our information technology department he's not here now, but our Office of Performance Improvement is looking into those types of things to improve processes, process improvement, continuous improvement on how we deliver our goods and services. So,
exactly.
So thank you. And I won't ask questions with regard to the controlled substance and how we handle those licensees, because we'll talk about that at another time. But thank you. We have a couple of governor citations, and we can maybe take some photos and then. Start. Madam Treasurer, do you have any comments for the good of the order?
No. That was such a great way to start, and I look forward to these lessons learned being applied all over, including some offices that we have to deal with. Not the State Treasurer's office, which is right there in terms of customer service, but it is a pleasure to be here after two relatively cool days. And this is probably the peak of the good things happening. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, today is first day of summer, officially.
Yes, that's why it's the peak.
Okay. Mr. Comptroller.
As I often say, let summer be summer. And couldn't be happier that baseball season and cold Maryland beer is on everyone's agenda. If I... just wanted to thank you, Lieutenant Governor, and good morning, Madam Treasurer, also. Each year, more than 27,000 Marylanders are diagnosed with invasive cancer, including our very own governor, who battled his disease with incredible courage and strength. Each of us in this room knows someone who has been affected by cancer, and we're all aware of the devastation it can cause in people's lives. But each and every day, medical researchers and experts are working hard to find a cure for this horrible and deadly disease. And with the number of world-class public and private universities and medical research institutions that call our state home, Maryland is truly leading the nation, and indeed the world, in ending the pain and suffering that cancer inflicts on so many people every day. Last month, a team of medical researchers from Johns Hopkins announced that they've discovered a potential method to stop cancer metastasis, which, of course, is the spreading of the disease that is responsible for most of the deaths that occur from cancer. The researchers at Hopkins discovered the biomedical signaling process that leads to metastasis. Maybe I'm mispronouncing that. And more importantly, what they've identified how what the signals are, and more importantly, they've identified what they call a drug cocktail that can slow down the spreading of the cancer cells throughout the body. This is an incredible and promising breakthrough. I just wanted to publicly thank and congratulate the research team at Hopkins and others. And it's not just stopping the signaling of the cancer cells. It's also, there's all sorts of research at Hopkins on energizing the body's immune system. For example, there are two drugs that are prescribed for malignant melanoma of the brain. One drug costs $100,000 and extends the life of the individual by 4 months. The other drug costs $100,000 also and extends the life of the cancer victim by 5 months. When put together, the two drugs cost $200,000, obviously, but they create, for some reason, a complete remission.
in the cancer. So this idea of treating cancer with, you know, cocktails like HIV and other diseases are treated, I think, are the way to the future. And as the chief fiscal officer, I desperately want the new discoveries to be manufactured in Maryland. I'll leave that for others, but there's good news out there for this absolutely terrifying disease that so many of our friends and neighbors and family members have. And a lot of it's happening right here in Maryland.
Thank you, Governor. Thank you, Mr. Comptroller. And we do, fortunately, in our state, have fine institutions like Hopkins and the University of Maryland Medical, but also a very thriving biohealth industry in our state. And so we are fortunate from that standpoint. Okay. Madam Secretary, turn to your agenda.
Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, thank you. We have 16 items on your Secretary's agenda this morning.
Okay. I just want to point out item 10. That's the Baltimore Food Pub grant.
Both from the Department of Housing and Community Development and from American Communities Trust.
Okay.
This is an exciting project.
Yes, this is. Good morning. My name is Carol Gilbert, and I'm here to represent Secretary Holt in this agenda item. This is a project that's long in the making, but is showing amazing progress. Thank you to the governor's strong budget in support of the Food Hub, which is a multi-phase development with historic buildings and new infill, and will provide opportunities for nonprofits, particularly, and other food-oriented enterprises producing jobs for local residents. We had a groundbreaking last fall, and we're looking forward to a ribbon cutting on the first phase of the development later this year. And it, the state's funds total approximately $4 million out of a $23 million budget. And this is really one of the most innovative projects we've had the privilege to work on and manage. And if there are any specific questions, the expert in the room is really China Boat Terrell, the CEO of American Communities Trust.
Tell me a little bit more about what's actually going to take place. I understand you're going to have hoop houses and you're going to be growing food.
Yes, sir.
So.
Yes, sir. The development is just beside the train tracks as folks come in and out of Union Station, so it's been a very derelict campus for probably 20-some years. And the open space will become public space for the community, but also a growing space for urban gardeners. The first facility is a new building that will house primarily Humanum City Seed Enterprise, which is now a catering business that will be able to expand into this new facility and provide jobs and training for local residents. And then these residents will be subcontracted out to local facilities for catering projects. And the new facility will allow them to expand their business greatly. That Food Hub business will also be open to local entrepreneurs that make cookies, salad dressings, you know, things that they can make they've been making out of their homes but need a commercial kitchen to really expand and offer their fares to large companies in Baltimore. The other five buildings on the site are very historic. If you were to go by the site today, you'd see, you know, the roofs coming back on in an exciting progress towards stabilizing the structures, which our grants have also helped make happen. Though the first building that's going to be finished will include the American Heart Association as a tenant, where they'll provide healthy heart training, and then a number of other food businesses. I'm going to ask China to say a little bit more about those specific tenants that are anticipated.
Sure. Thank you, everyone. And just let me echo what Assistant Secretary Carroll said. The state has been an incredible partner for us, and I'm so very proud. So thank you, Treasurer Cobb. Thank you, Lieutenant Rutherford. And thank you also to Governor Hogan and thank you, Comptroller Franchot, and thank you also, of course, to Secretary Ken Holt, whom, I like to call him Clint Eastwood, but he's been amazing. And then also to Secretary Mike Gill, who has been a fantastic partner as well. With regard to our tenants in the building, we have, of course, as Assistant Secretary Gilbert said, the American Heart Association. We're thrilled about that because our catchment area includes the neighborhoods in Baltimore of Oliver, Broadway East, Berea, as well as the new Eager Park, just where Johns Hopkins is. And Berea was recently reported to have the lowest life expectancy in Baltimore among their neighborhoods. So we're very proud of having the American Heart Association there. In addition, we are in the process of finalizing our letter of intent with Urban Pastoral, and the owner of that won a Social Innovation Award from the Johns Hopkins University. He's a vertical grower, but is bringing a food retail concept to the site, as well as a brewery. And if many of you know that Central East Baltimore is home to brewery production. Just up the road, Humanum, is in the American Brewery building. And then,
you're talking to Junior Brewer over here.
Comptroller Franchot, I think that you and my husband would get along very well. And then, in addition, we also have, I'm very excited to have a letter of intent from the Land of Kush, which is a vegan soul food.
Now, are they moving?
No, they're expanding.
Oh, okay.
So, and this is a great thing. And so we will look forward to working with them and converting what they're doing to Elise. They will be collaborating with us and another very experienced grocer to bring a market to the site, which allows us through the state's grants to eliminate the food desert within a quarter mile radius of the site. And then in addition, we just recently have a letter of intent from a salad dressing maker who currently manufactures her product in the state of Wisconsin, but is from Maryland and says, like all of us, why are we having those jobs in Wisconsin, right? So we want to figure out a way to bring those jobs back to Maryland. So I can tell you that right now our site is about 70% leased. If you know of other food tenants, please contact me. But even with being 70% leased, we're projecting about 200 permanent jobs over the course of the next 7 years, and that does not include our 160 construction jobs, the bulk of which will come from our phase two. We're meeting all of our MBE and MWE targets at this point, 27% MBE and 10% MWE. And so thanks to Carter Site Services, as well as Caliber Construction and Urban Green, who have all kept us at budget and on schedule. So it's an incredible project because we're creating a lending market in an incredibly distressed community. This project absolutely would not be possible without the state's strong support. And where we have had roadblocks, your Clint Eastwood has come in. Secretary Holt has come in and helped us clear those roadblocks. And so we're incredibly grateful to the administration. And I think that this is something that everyone in this room can be proud of, because now when the 1 million people go by every year on Amtrak, they're going to look over at our site and they're going to say that Maryland is a state of progress, and that it's a state where no city gets left behind.
Very good.
I probably did not deserve it, but one of the brewers actually named a beer after me.
We've heard that.
What is it so we can check it out and see if it's any good?
Oh, my goodness.
Uh-oh. Oh, yeah. That looks like Pete Frampton.
Yeah, that does look like Peter Frampton. A rock star, I will say, about Peter Frampton.
Most of the people in here probably don't even remember Pete Frampton. But
I should mention that we will be back soon. I should mention that we will be back soon because we were very fortunate to receive an award from the state to help us wrap up our phase two, which, of course, is very necessary. And so hopefully when I come back, I can show you all pictures of what it is that you have funded. I'd love to be able to do that.
Well, I'd like to come down and see what's going on.
I would love for you to come. Lieutenant Rutherford, I've been trying to get in touch with you. So this is great. Yes.
I'm right here.
Which one is your staff member? Okay.
Gentleman sitting down there.
Perfect. Sounds wonderful.
Okay.
What are you doing? Are you doing any signage that will allow those of us who ride on Amtrak to actually see what we can, because it is a little depressing sometimes.
Yes. And we are doing signage. And, in fact, we signed with a firm that I believe will help us create iconic signage that represents well the state of Maryland and Baltimore City. And so right now we may need a little bit of help just because we're in an urban renewal district is what I believe that it's called. And so there are certain regulations with regard to the signage. But we look forward to shouting from the rooftops about everything that's taking place at this site. And so we just have to figure out how to do that tastefully. But we want this to be a place of pride for anyone going by on the train and seeing what the site looks like.
Very good.
Thank you.
And although I'm not a vegan or vegetarian, I have eaten at Land of Kush. The kale salad is extremely good. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And thank you also to Madam Secretary Sheila McDonald, who has been wonderful. Thank you.
All right. Kind of like the Oscars or something with all the thank yous. So, any other questions on the Secretary's agenda? Do we have a motion?
Favorable.
Okay. All in favor? I think it's 3-0.
Thank you.
Department of Natural Resources.
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Mark Belton, Secretary of the Department of Resources, and we have 13 items on our real property agenda for your approval this morning.
I have a question about 3A, and I guess it goes to also 4A and 5A. I'm just not familiar with the Agricultural Security Corridor, Rural Legacy Area, that concept. So if you can just explain that a little bit.
Good morning. Emily Wilson with the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. Thank you. The Agricultural Security Corridor is actually a series of rural legacy areas in that mid to upper shore region. And the basic concept behind it is to ensure the security of the agricultural production in that upper shore region, hence the name of that series of rural legacy areas in that upper shore region.
So, but in reading some of the material, this is purchasing additional easements in areas where you already have an easement. Or it's adjacent to an existing easement? Is that how?
These are actually all within rural legacy areas. So okay. In order to qualify for rural legacy funding, you have to first be in a designated rural legacy area. Mm-hmm. So the Agricultural Security Corridor is a series of areas in that mid to upper shore region. And then we look to purchase easements on properties within those rural legacy areas. So these four projects before you today are, yes, adjacent to other existing rural legacy properties and perhaps some MALF properties. And the whole... MALF, Maryland Agricultural Land Preservation Foundation.
Okay.
So the idea is to put together a patchwork of conservation of working lands, again, to secure that agricultural production in that area.
Okay. So in a sense, it kind of links these properties together.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you. That was, I just want to give a little explanation.
I have a question about item 13. Please. So while you're looking at that, we're being asked to approve a request to commit $3.44 million in program open space funds to acquire approximately 1,664 acres of forested forest land along Route 13 in Somerset County. According to the background notes, the department intends to use this land to produce sustainable forest products to help sustain a local resource-based economy and to provide recreational opportunities such as hunting, fishing, birding, and hiking. I support obviously the goals of sustaining resource-based economic development and providing land-based activities. And I love program open space, but this strikes me as a red light example of mission creep.
strain outside what the goal was for program open space. Now, obviously, we all value recreational activity, but I thought it was based upon conserving land at the risk of being developed. Is there any evidence that any of this land is subject ever in the next 100 years to development?
One of the basic tenets of program open space is for outdoor recreation before the cost of land accelerates too much to the point where we may be able to lose it. And one of the basic tenets of Chesapeake Forest Lands is not just for production of sustainable forestry practices, but as the item mentions and as you mentioned, it is for recreational purposes. So there will be hunting, hiking, bird watching, and potentially camping that's provided on these properties as there is for the existing Chesapeake Forest lands.
Well, I understand that. I can see that. I understand what you're saying. I just don't agree with you that that is the core priority and mission of Program Open Space. For me, I happen to think it's building parks, pools, ball fields, other recreational items on land at the risk of development, and that will improve the quality of life for families living in that region. So, yes, I can understand that people can hunt and fish on forest land, but I don't see that land as appropriately being awarded $3.5 million in limited program open space dollars, given the fact that there's zero chance it's going to be developed.
Actually, program open space has two components. You have program open space local side and program open space stateside. This is a purchase using program open space stateside dollars, where the basic tenant there is for outdoor recreational purposes. Program open space local side is where you see the more intensely developed recreational activities, including ball fields, swim centers, playgrounds, things of that like.
Okay. I could see that explanation. I just don't agree with it. And I'd like you to send us who's going to be benefiting from foresting land down there that we are paying a ton of money for. And I guess we're going to provide it for resource development. I see it as mission creep, and I hope that you can re-examine what you've got, because buying this type of property can quickly lead to some odd situations, and one of which is here before us.
Well, a couple of points, too. Again, we are required by statute to obtain 2 independent appraisals, which we did, and the price for which we're paying is based off of those independent appraisals, and, in fact, we're paying below what the higher appraisal came in.
Here, do me a favor. Before you give the $3.5 million, I guess we're voting on it today, but why don't you ask if anybody would like to buy it? Because I love Somerset County, but it's the most economically disadvantaged area in the state. And there's just, I just happened to flag this in order to have you guys take a close look at what you're doing, because it's a lot of money for forest land for people to hunt on, I guess, I take it. I mean, are there trails in this property?
Yes.
Well, whose trails are they?
Don, you want to come up and explain a little bit more?
Yeah.
And I will also say that a lot of times you have to remember, too, that when these lands are purchased and used in the state public lands resources, that the hunting and the hiking, bird watching, camping, things like that are all economic drivers in that area where it's bringing in folks. These were privately held lands, and so at this time they're going to be open for the public that will bring more people into the area for those recreational pursuits.
Good morning. My name is Don Van Hassen. I'm the director of the Maryland Forest Service, part of DNR.
And we are the managers of Chesapeake Forest Land, which this would be in addition to, throughout the entire 67,700 acres of Chesapeake Forest. We manage it all sustainably according to two international known certifying bodies. We produce forest products off of all of it. We have public hunting on the majority of it. And there's plenty of opportunity for the public to recreate, to hiking, bird watching, hunting, fishing. On this particular series of properties here that totaled 1,600 acres. It was previously held. It was previously leased to hunting groups. There are trails on it. There will be trails on it if we own it. And there will be further recreational development opportunities if we acquire it. There will be further analysis of what exactly is there and how we can best manage it to provide public benefits.
But how did it come to your attention?
Actually, the landowner approached the Nature Conservancy looking for a conservation buyer, and the Nature Conservancy then approached us, seeing that this was adjacent to existing Chesapeake Forest lands and would be consistent with the way that we would manage properties in that
exactly
area.
Exactly my point. I mean, where does it end? Why wouldn't any private owner of land that is unsellable, probably, not approach the state of Maryland and say, gee, we have some nice forests here? In theory, people can go and look for birds in the forest. Please, could you write us a check for $3.44 million of taxpayers' money so that we can get rid of this land? I mean, we've forested it, we've harvested the wood off it, we've done this, that, and the other thing. It's in Somerset County. Isn't Somerset where we paid millions of dollars for sub-aquatic vegetation a number of years ago? Remember that incident?
I do not.
Yeah, we bought some swampland. It was underwater in Somerset County. I think we did. I know I opposed it, but I assume it might have passed by a 2-to-1 vote. But that was a...
Did I go for that?
No, you weren't around.
I don't think I was involved in that one. No.
From the swamp of my memory here. I would urge the agency, and I have a lot of respect for the secretary, to assess what exactly is the standards are for going forward with, particularly if it's just people approaching us. Or approaching some conservation group and having the conservation group come and approach us. Because it seems to be an endless line of possible places where the taxpayers would pay money. And that, I agree, it's state money, but it doesn't mean that it can't be used for purposes that would protect ecologically sensitive land. Did this have an ecologically sensitive score?
100.
Can I ask on that? The scoring is actually done? I know I got a briefing a while ago on the scoring, what the numbers mean, but that's been something that I've wanted to get a better idea or understanding of.
Sure. So it's looked at from a number of different standpoints. We look at the area in general first, and we look at things like green infrastructure, you know, what are the contiguous green lands, open space areas in that area? Are there rare species? Is there aquatic life present in the area? And forests important for water quality protection. And then we take those same parameters and we look at it on the specific parcel level. And then we determine whether or not it's in a targeted ecological area, which this one is. Then we also look at, is it adjacent to existing lands? Does it have some historical or cultural value? What kind of recreational opportunities might there be provided on the property? And then we look at, well, what kinds of work may need to be done in order to potentially restore parts of the property? And then we also look at it from a climate change adaptation standpoint. Because we do take very seriously the idea of if it's going to be subject to sea level rise within a certain time period, then we don't want to be spending public dollars on land that we know, as you mentioned, is going to be subject to sea level rise within a certain time period. And then we also look at how many acres of land is protected in within a mile of this particular piece of property.
Well,
all of
those
are added up.
Governor, I think it's an excellent question, and I haven't heard at risk of development. Where is the risk to the ecologically significant land here?
Well, again, we actually look at it from a positive standpoint that this landowner was willing to continue to want to see this property in a conservation mindset. And Pergam Open Space isn't just about the threat of development. Like, we're not going to go necessarily into a municipality per se and use Pergam Open Space dollars. That's not actually where the targeted ecological areas are. So we look at it from the standpoint of what kind of recreational opportunities will that property provide and what kind of economic sustainability may there be provided in that region as a result of the state acquiring that property, again, in terms of the economic development from the tourism dollars, the economic development and the use of many times local timber companies for timber production on Chesapeake Forest lands.
I hate to belabor this, but I think it's an important point. Where does all this end? I mean, you have land all over the state of Maryland that obviously has contiguous private owners that would love to have the state do some kind of appraisal and pay them money. Is the landowner still going to be involved in the who benefits from the forestry? After this is consummated, this deal.
If there are any timber sales, it would be state, correct?
Obviously, the state would get income from any timber sales, but the local economy, the forest operators would be the ones who would be being able to maintain their business. There's a land base that they have to operate from, because once you harvest, you're not going to be in there for another 30, 40 years. So there has to be sufficient land base. So anybody who's associated with the logging company, anybody who's associated with the next user of the product, whether it's a sawmill, whether it's a pulp mill, and all the associated, all that equipment that's used to harvest the timber, machinery, repair places that service those kind of equipment, all those kind of businesses in the local economy.
And when is it scheduled to be harvested next?
That we'll have to see when.
When was it last harvested?
I don't know the history of this, the actual harvest history of this property. If we were to acquire this, we would evaluate to see just what the actual condition of the forest is. Does it need to be thinned now? Does it need to be regenerated now? Is it growing well? We just need to let it grow larger. Incorporated with all that is how can we fold into that the recreational aspect of the property.
Okay. So there's nothing bad that would happen if we looked at this at the next meeting and you got back to me on when the last harvest sale was, because, as you said, if it's 40 years from now when the next one might happen.
It could be next year.
I mean, why don't you ask the landowner
what the condition is?
Why don't you ask the beneficiary of the taxpayers when exactly the property was last harvested? And if my colleagues were willing to put it off for 2 weeks, I'd be interested in that.
Is it critical that this be approved today?
I mean, in all honesty, it's not critical.
All honesty. We appreciate
fiscal
that.
Year, and we do count acreage numbers on a fiscal year basis.
Yeah. Is there any concern about the end of the fiscal year?
Well, again, from an acreage standpoint and goals that we target to meet, that's what the concern would be.
Well, we won't penalize you on that. So, okay.
If I can make one more point on this, that you asked the comptroller and wasn't, I think, fully addressed, and that was, when does this end? As you all realize, there is a Bay Program goal for the Chesapeake Bay Program of preserving water, watershed-wide in the six states and the District of Columbia, 2 million acres between 2010 and 2025. And so Maryland has a portion of that 2 million acres that we are to permanently preserve. And we try to do that using by appropriate or by buying very ecologically sensitive property. And we have a scoring system that you have heard explained that helps us determine that. So this is an ecologically sensitive property per the scoring system in a targeted ecological area. And it helps us achieve our Bay Program goal and the goals that have been set by the Maryland legislature for land preservation, permanent preservation moving in the future.
How far along are we toward the goal, the regional goal?
I'm not sure regionally.
We're 2 million of that goal.
Maryland is on track to meet its what we determined as our portion of that moving goal.
2 million is the regional goal.
Is the regional. I thought it was the state.
Okay. Oh, no, that's the entire watershed.
Okay.
No, and I have great confidence in the Secretary. I think you run a tremendous agency. I don't mean to bring up a disagreement here, but obviously the premise of preserving 2 million acres in the Chesapeake region is that those 2 million acres would, but for the preservation of them, be developed or at least have some scintilla of a chance of being developed, which I guarantee you this acquisition in 100 years doesn't have a sliver of a chance, because I've been to Somerset, and it's my favorite place in the state. In fact, we'll be heading down there pretty soon to Chrisfields, right? And so I'm not stating anything other than the obvious, which is the justification has to be something other than us meeting a goal. It's got to have some common sense attached to it. And so anyway, can all be harvested and help the local economy starting immediately. And the director is going to get back to me with some information.
I think the comptroller, you asked very good questions with regard to the program of open space, and I've had questions about it before, more so when it's properties that are going to be controlled by another entity and they're not open to the public, which this is different. This is going to be within the state's authority, and it will be open to the public. And I've been concerned where we purchase property and they're held by different trusts, but they're not open to the public to use it. And it becomes, if you're a cynic, it becomes someone's private playground at the state expense. This is not the case. I would be willing to defer this because it's not critical at this point. You can still reach your goals, and, you know, as with, you know, questions being answered. So,
Governor, I just say, the two of you want to defer it, and Ellen says it doesn't do any great harm to actually obtaining the property, Mr. Secretary, is that right? I think maybe we need one more briefing, not that there haven't been any, but one more briefing on the purpose of program open space and the maps and how it works. I would point out this is right on the highway and right outside of town. It, in fact, I would hate to see it develop, because it would then interrupt what looks like finally we are putting together a set, you said, a patchwork of ecologically sensitive and important space. But if in order to get to that goal, which is in the law and which I thought we all supported, postponing it for 2 weeks would be helpful with that understanding, I wouldn't object to it.
Be happy to do that.
Yeah.
That's a yes.
That's a yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. I think we have three. Thank you very much.
It's a yes with an understand we're going to go forward, and this is not simply a way to stall the program, to misrepresent the program, and to have the property go in another direction.
Well, if that's directed at me.
It's directed at the world.
Okay. I think it's a perfectly legitimate area to look at, and we have a lot of program open space needs in our communities around the state, where the state can help out the locals, as you do, but this is, I appreciate the Lieutenant Governor's comments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Any other questions?
Yes. Project, I'm sorry, 7, I think. Yes. Rural Legacy Program funding in Calvert County. The easement. I just want to say on the record that Delegate Clark, I'd be happy to hear with Delegate Clark, expressed a strong interest and strong support on behalf of the county and the community for this project.
Okay.
Yes, I'm Greg Bowen. I'm executive director of the American Chestnut Land Trust, and I believe we have a lot of support down there. We appreciate the letter from the delegate, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Well, tell me a little bit about the acquisition of this the conservation easement and the impact that it will have.
Great. So the property is been in the Rural Legacy Area from the original establishment of Rural Legacy Area in Calvert County. We've been very successful in the Rural Legacy Area thanks to the state, thanks to our own land trust and private property owners. Well over 70% of that Rural Legacy Area in that portion has already been protected. This one is key to us because it takes us right to the edge of the Parker's Creek watershed. With the protection of this property, we started out by protecting the piece on the southern edge of the watershed. This one gets us to the northern edge of the watershed. It is a property at risk of development. It's on a major county road. It's within 3 miles of Prince Frederick, but it also scored very high in the past for the ratings from a rating standpoint. We have a contract to buy the property from the owners, the current owners of the property. Our sale is contingent upon Rural Legacy easement. If we purchase the property and Rural Legacy easement monies come through, we will extend public access. We have 22 miles of trails in the properties that we own or manage, and this will allow us to extend public access all the way to Dares Beach. Currently, we have a trail that runs from Prince Frederick to the bay, thanks to the help of Department of Natural Resources, a number of private property owners, including a church right in Prince Frederick. You can walk out from that church to the bay. We've recently set up a trail system that allows us to go from south to north, crossing Parker's Creek. And so it's a unique opportunity for us to kind of finish the pieces of the puzzle in that portion of the area. It's the largest piece left.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you said the public access part, because that's the concern I've had with a number of these projects. Well, thank you very much. Oh, and how else is the so you said you're in the process of potentially purchasing the property.
Yes.
How is the rest of the property used now? Is it for agricultural purposes? Are they row crops and the like?
85% of this 405-acre tract is forest, and it protects our upland wetlands areas, our streams.
Watershed, yeah.
But there is a 60-acre farm on the property. We hope to continue to farm it.
Okay.
So that land will stay in agriculture.
In production. Good.
Yes.
Good. Thank you very much. Any other questions on Department of Natural Resources? We have a motion to approve. Okay. All of us, I think, are in favor. Thank you. Department of Budget and Management.
Lieutenant Governor, Comptroller, Treasurer, David Brinkley, Secretary of the Department of Budget and Management. We've introduced 6 items for your consideration, and I've withdrawn item 2S, and I have been here to address any concerns or questions you may have.
Okay. I just want to hear a little bit about number 3, the contract utilizing Bay Restoration Funds.
Jack Kuhman, Director of the Maryland Water Quality Financing Administration.
Lieutenant Governor, my name is Jack Kuhman with the Department of the Environment, Water Quality Financing Administration, and we implement the Bay Restoration Fund for the state of Maryland.
Okay.
What would you like to know about this?
I understand this is a statewide contract or a procurement to allow for upgrades of septic systems that the locals can actually utilize this contract to get better prices to do these upgrades.
Essentially, we give a block grant to each of the counties to implement the program to upgrade septic systems with nitrogen-removing technologies within the critical areas.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of all 24 or 23 counties doing separate procurements, we felt it's more efficient for the state to do a procurement to get the best prices for each county and then allow those counties to use those prices.
Okay. Now, and the septic system upgrades are in those critical areas?
By law, they are required in the critical areas.
Mm-hmm.
However, the local governments can choose to do them outside the critical areas if they believe it protects water quality and public health.
Thank you.
I wanted to thank you for bringing the subject up. So how do you identify these systems that get upgraded?
Actually, the county local health departments take applications from homeowners, and they know which properties are in the critical areas, which of those are failing,
uh-huh.
and they prioritize them as failing in the critical areas priority one, and so on. And they select, the local governments select the candidates for upgrade of septic systems. But it's mostly voluntary on the part of the homeowner, except if you're in the critical areas and you need a repair, you have no choice.
Okay. What about inspecting it if you're in the critical area?
So that you
both save yourself a lot of money and the environment avoids a lot of contamination. What kind of testing requirement is there of septic systems within the critical area?
This part of this grant, the homeowner does get 2 years of annual operations and maintenance included. How after that, as part of the grant agreement, the homeowner must maintain the system, which must be checked annually by a certified operator, and it's part of the contract. And there's a database that the department has where we know which systems have been inspected annually and which have not.
That's your system for the new. For the upgrades.
For the upgrades.
That's terrific. What about all the other septic systems that are not failing but are not far away from failing?
For the most part, they are left to the local health departments to enforce regular pump outs and stuff like
right.
that.
If you could just, because you're an expert on this, send me something on generally what occurs to homeowners who may not understand that a septic system needs to be maintained.
Okay.
I mean, apparently 7% of the American people think that chocolate milk comes from a brown cow. But if you own a property, and particularly if you've grown up in a city, you may have no idea
just flush
that
it
a
goes
septic
somewhere.
It may just be, huh? Really? And I don't know what the proper maintenance is, but to the extent you could just help me understand locally, if there are mandates to maintain septic systems, and if not, why not?
I'll get you some information.
Yeah.
But certainly for the BAD installations we are doing as part of the grants, they are sort of regulated more than the rest of the stuff.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
sir. Any other questions on budget management?
Move approval.
Okay. We're all in favor here. Thank you very much. University system, apparently.
Good morning. Joe Evans, representing the University System of Maryland. We have 8 items on the agenda. Here to answer any questions.
Okay. 4AE, I want to just say on 4AE, I am very pleased that this is put into the Small Business Reserve for architectural and engineering design services. I want to say thank you for doing that. I'd like to see some of the other agencies, and we'll get to Mr. Ports in a few minutes, to look to putting more projects into the Small Business Reserve. Now, the only caveat I have, and I know this, I don't know if this is the first time the university system has done that.
It's not. My campus has also done this.
Okay.
We've had one for, one on 4 years now.
Okay. Good. My only caveat is that the limit on the task orders at $100,000, I know for a fact that some of the small, maybe not these that have been selected, but the smaller A&E firms, many of them can do much larger projects than $100,000 projects. So I'd like you to ask your folks to do some more market research and possibly come back when they are looking at additional ones that may be as high as $1 million for Small Business Reserve for A&E contracts.
Yes, sir.
So, but I commend the fact that the university system is doing this. Questions on the university?
The Brendan Arebe Center, which is a great project, what is the timing of the completion?
I'd like to bring up Bill Orlin, who is the Director of Design and Construction for Cops.
Good morning, Governor. Comptroller Francho, Treasurer Kopp. Construction will be ending up next July, so a little over a year from now. We're expecting occupancy of the building January of 19.
That is going to be a great event, I think, for the university and the entire College Park community. It's going to change the whole orientation of the
campus. Is looking forward to the opening as far as a center of innovation, technology advancement, interaction with private companies,
exciting.
And generating jobs.
Very exciting. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Good. Other questions? Just something, I know this is not within your pay grade, and we'll talk to the regents with regard to this, but in terms of future, one of the concerns I've had, and I have expressed it to the governor, is that often in the projects that come in for major capital improvements, particularly at College Park more so than others, that you get a donor, a philanthropist who comes in and they say, oh, we'll put $10 million to this project. And they say, okay, we'll name the building after you. But the building costs $145 million. And the university system comes to the state and says, hey, if you don't give us this money in the capital project, we're going to lose this measly $10 million. That maybe the regents need to say, that's nice, thanks for the donation, but to get your name on the building, you got to come up with a higher percentage. I don't know what that is. Maybe it's half, maybe it's 75%. But I've seen that a couple of times in some of our capital budget discussions, and the university system, not you guys, a little higher in the chain or lower in the chain, depending on which your perspective, are saying, we got to get this into the budget now. We got to get it into planning, or we're going to lose this $10 million on a $145 million building. And so I
think that's a big matter.
I'm kind of liking having the lieutenant governor here. How much did Mr. Reavy contribute?
He contributed $33 million. His mom, $3 million on top of that, and then his business partner, another $4 million. So
and
large,
how long?
It was one of our larger donations.
How long did he study at the University of Maryland?
He was on campus a short period of time.
For what, like a semester?
Yes.
So one semester tuition.
Yeah. Imagine what he would have given if he'd been there 4 years. But we're very grateful for that. And the total cost of the building is what?
A little over $149 million.
Well, I think the lieutenant governor makes a very valid point that goes not just to the cost, but the function. For example, this obviously fits in, as the treasurer says, into an exciting part of College Park's growth. But what if it didn't? What if it was something else that was...
I'm not picking on this particular project. I'm just saying generally. I'm just saying general aspects that sometimes there are projects that sound good. The university may want to do it, but it might be lower in their priority in terms of needing a new such-and-such building, not necessarily this one. But because a donor comes in and is willing to put up 10% of the cost, and that's building, that's not maintenance. That's another thing that has always been a concern of mine back to when I was at DGS, is that the state has to maintain these buildings. And often we are so quick to build new buildings because everyone likes to be at a ribbon cutting, but no one is there to put a new HVAC system in or paint or repair the piping or whatever has to happen 5, 10, 15 years down the line. So that's just something to carry back to the other folks when they come in and they say, we're going to build this new building. We want to tear down this other building here and put something else there.
We'll do that, sir.
Okay. Tell Mr. Arabi I said nice things about
it. I will.
Any other questions on the university? Do we have a motion to approve?
We have approved.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I wasn't picking on that particular place, but it just...
That is going to be a great building, and he is a great donor.
And I appreciate that. But I just feel that, you know, name doesn't need to be on the building if you're...
I agree with that.
If you're going to put... It's like you could have a plaque
and
a couple of bricks.
And I think your point that it and the controllers that it has to be within the programmatic plan and needs of the university. Absolutely right. Which is one of the reasons, since we've done it, it's amazing that they're building a building for the School of Public Policy, which usually doesn't get big donors and isn't at the top of the hotshot list, and yet vital to the function of the university.
Okay. Very good. Department of Information. I'm sorry.
I'm just saying, I think, I don't mean to be didactic.
Not at all. Department of Information Technology.
Good morning, Mr. Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Michael Leahy, the Acting Secretary of the Department of Information Technology. Today we have four items on your agenda, and I do have representatives available to answer any questions you may have.
I didn't have any questions.
Neither do I. Move approval unless someone has any.
Okay, well, easy here.
Thank you, sir.
Well, I guess we're all in favor, so thank you. Department of Transportation.
Good morning, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, Governor. For the record, my name is Jim Forts, Deputy Secretary, Maryland Department of Transportation. The department is presenting 19 items for your consideration today. We are withdrawing 16 LT at this time. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions you may have.
Secretary Ports, can you take back to State Highway questions on A&E of whether they can look? I know MDTA was in here at one point when I was here saying that they were going to have some A&E contracts in Small Business Reserve. I don't remember seeing them. I do look at the books before, even when the governor is going and I'm not here. But if you can take it back to State Highway to look at their A&E contracts and what they can put into the Small Business Reserve would be much appreciated.
We had that conversation again on Monday.
Okay.
And Eric Lomboy, who has recently taken over the State Highways procurement area, has put something in place where he is telling all of his procurement officers that they must try and go to the Small Business Reserve program, and if not, they need to come to him for a reason why not.
Very good.
So you should see that as we move forward. Some of these are prior to some of that occurring, but you'll see that moving forward.
Okay. Herb, you should like that, right? Good. Good to hear. did, are you replacing it with a Georgia Peak? Was there, or is she still there?
So Georgia Peak was, she was at State Highway, she went to MTA, she is now at MVA, Motor Vehicle Administration.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Good memory, yeah. Okay.
Some things. I remember a lot, but some things. Okay. I have a question on 5C mod. It's a $1.2 million modification. Salt Dome project. I noticed that a number of the reasons for the modification have to do with design problems, design error, design omission, and design omission. Are we able to recover anything from the...
So you are correct. As you know, this contract was approved in 7/2/14. And you're absolutely correct. There's been a tremendous amount of design mishaps, modifications. And I guess I would have to say we have identified the fact that this group cannot design projects like this.
Past performance is a problem now. Mm-hmm.
So we are in the process of moving the design function out of the facilities and maintenance group.
Internally, it's, but the, who did this? Was it contracted design?
No, I think it was internal, wasn't it? Let me,
Were you looking? Where were you looking? Oh, I could
tell.
Yeah. I thought you were looking at Governor Schaefer for a moment.
No, this is Eric Lawson.
Eric Lawson, again, Director of Procurement for State Highway Administration. That actually was designed by consultants, so my office and the AG's office are now looking into what we can do to recoup some of the costs from the errors and omissions.
Okay. That's good. It's worth looking into because so many errors associated with this.
And just as a small note, of the money that was in this particular fund, $800,000 was for remediation of soil. That was actually an unanticipated consequence. So that one truly was something that we didn't.
Yeah, I mean, there are going to be situations where you open something up and there was no way of knowing until you opened it up that there's going to be these additional problems. But when it's a design error, that's and multiple omissions, you have to then say that there's a problem. Okay. Thank you. I want to point out, for the benefit of all of us, that I understand 8A, 8M, and a couple of the others, I think 10, were rebid because you had single bids previously and went back out and was able to get some competitive pricing, particularly in 8, where the pricing came in lower than what your estimate was. So make sure they don't come back with a change order that's over your estimate. But
well, we're trying.
Okay. So I just wanted to point that out, and thank you for
that. Well, thank you.
Any questions on the
transportation? Yeah, item 14.
Had it open to that one.
Funny thing.
Mr. Boss.
So item 14 is a sole source contract to New Flyer Industries out of Canada for 140 new diesel transit buses at a total cost of nearly $81.5 million in state and federal funds. I recall back in January of last year, the department had a single bid contract also for diesel transit buses, also to New Flyer. That was a single bid contract for 172 transit buses. I remember questioning the department about the lack of bid competition at the time and recall that the response was that there are a limited number of bus manufacturers that meet federal Buy America requirements and a severe backlog for the companies that do make buses this size. I guess my question is, in the last 18 months, we haven't made any more progress in the U.S. in making a bus, making a bus that we can bid and buy, made in America?
So there are 4 manufacturers that meet the Buy America criteria, and produce the size buses that, that we have. And my understanding from the department is, or the MTA, is that you're correct. They went out and there was a single bid. And the way this works, since there's only four manufacturers in the, that can meet the Buy America criteria under the federal standards, they're doing, they're producing all the buses for the entire nation, for every transit system in the nation, and probably beyond. And so the trick is trying to be able to get into their queue, especially for the number of buses that, that you want, because the manufacturers only have so much capacity. Once they're at capacity, you cannot get into their queue to manufacture a bus. And so the reason, my understanding is the reason that we had the original single bid is because no other manufacturer could fit us into their queue for that number of buses, which is 170-plus buses. Fast forward to this one, we ended up being in the same predicament because the timeline for our procurement was too short to be able to then, again, produce a competition to fit into the queue. So what this one is for is to get us through that gap so that we can produce a multi-year contract in the out years, moving out far enough that we'll be able to get into all the manufacturer's queue so that we can have a competitive bid.
What is the life of these buses?
12 years. Usually.
Usually.
Usually about 12 years.
Now, okay.
No, please go ahead.
So now at this point with adding, the 140, when will they be delivered?
I'm sorry, what?
When will the 140 in this contract be delivered? The expectation of it?
Delivered? Sure. Come on, Dave.
Whoever knows the answer.
Yeah, Dave Varner. Oh, and coming up to the podium here is Kevin Quinn. He's the new administrator for MTA and the, I would say, the planner and architect for the new Baltimore Link system.
Mr. Baltimore Link?
He's the brains behind Baltimore Link.
Mr. Quinn, why don't you introduce yourself on the record?
Sure.
Good morning. My name is Kevin Quinn. I'm the acting administrator and CEO of the Maryland Transit Administration.
Yeah. Good morning. I'm David Bonner. I'm the director of bus maintenance with the Maryland Transit Administration.
Okay. So when will the 140 come online or be in Maryland?
It takes about a year. The first pilot bus will be here about March of 2018. We always get a pilot bus up first. We've got to go through the testing and everything else. And then the first deliveries start in around June of 2018. And then it goes on for the whole contract.
Okay. Now, the previous 170, what's that number there on the street now?
There's 171, actually. We got one left at the plant that's due to come within the next couple of weeks, and then that contract will be done.
Okay. So you're going to have a sufficient or a large number of buses from the same manufacturer. Does that mean the, you know, the maintenance equipment and all is consistent, and our technicians, which used to be called mechanics, are able to work on consistency?
Correct. Yeah, okay. It's the same buses they've had for the this contract here and the one before that. So they're familiar with it, less training dollars we've got to spend on it, less parts, you know, different manufacturers, you know, different windows and things like this. All that is staying consistent with this one.
Okay. So how does a Canadian company meet the federal Buy America requirements? I assume even though the buses may be constructed in
the
United States, the profits go flying up to Canada, right? Okay, so that seems, well, that's a typical misstep, I guess.
They're American.
You got the bus engine manufacturers. It's the components of the bus. Even though, you know, they're the headquarters, they do the basic frames, everything else. The engine is Cummins, the American, and the transmissions are Allison. So it's all the components of it that make up, and that's how they meet the Buy America. It's the percentage of the whole bus.
Just obviously seems a little odd. Yeah. Much as I like Canada, I like them almost as much as Australia. We are just my two favorite countries. Australia, because they have kangaroos, of course. But
Canada is a wonderful neighbor of ours. But my concern here is that we get a single big contract that somehow has morphed into a sole source contract. How could that possibly be permitted under our procurement law? Because my understanding of sole source is that we're talking about something unique, proprietary, like a IBM software product or something. I can understand that as sole source. But a diesel bus is...
I believe it's sole source because they're the only company that can meet the criteria to fit us into their queue at this time.
Well, that's a new definition for me. Is your procurement person here? How did someone possibly label this as sole source?
Can Zimmerman answer the question?
And it's a particular interest to me because it is based on a single bid contract. Now you're approaching us and saying this is a sole source contract.
Yeah. Mike Zimmerman, Director of Procurement for the Maryland Department of Transportation. Yeah. So I'm just stepping into the role, and I don't have a lot of history here, but I do.
But maybe you can explain just sole source justifications generally, and we can turn to Gabe as well, who's the procurement advisor.
I do believe that the reason for the sole source was because they actually just went to the vendor based on the fact that they knew that nobody else would be able to supply the bus.
Well, it says here under COMAR, 21050522, when the compatibility of equipment, accessories, or replacement parts is paramount consideration, and the procurement officer has determined that a competitive source selection cannot be used, and there is only one available source for the subject contract under COMAR 21.05.05, an award can be made to that bidder. Okay. So that's under COMAR.
Yeah, but it does look a little bit bootstrapped here to me. And the question is, did you, Mr. Secretary, Deputy Secretary, thank you, by the way, for the photo of
I think
Peter Frampton, not me, but
Peter Frampton, but Peter Francho. I was wondering what happened with Pete Frampton. He became comfortable with me. he got a haircut. Yeah. He stopped recording.
Yes. And misspelled his name.
Changed his name a little bit.
That's so. Why someone used the term rock star. But thank you very much. I appreciate it. No other comptroller in the country has ever had a beer named after them. So I'm happy to be there. But if you could...
Schaefer.
Except for Schaefer. Yeah, well... Yeah, Schaefer was... Put it this way, that's not as good a beer as the one.
We would agree.
Yeah. But if you could update me on, Mr. Ports, perhaps you could, 18 months after the single bid contract, did your staff circle back to the other three potential bidders and ask them whether we were still... unable to get into their queue through a competitive bid.
So if I can address that.
Did you update that?
We are preparing a competitive bid to put out on the street.
No, I know you are. But
so that did anyone... Hopefully we'll answer that question.
Yeah, but we're doing something that says that bid, no matter how competitive and how much savings there are, is not going to take effect for 4 years.
Correct.
And that's... potentially quite a bit of money, I would take it, since these are diesel buses.
Thank you.
So just to answer your question, it sounded like from our folks that we did reach out to the other vendors to confirm that they weren't able to meet the schedule delivery.
Who sounds like who?
Sounds like Dave.
No. Well, we actually took lessons learned from the last procurement. That was one of the things that came up when we went and talked to the bus manufacturers that were out there, that they're backlogged. They just can't compete. And that's why they won't bid on it because they know they can't meet that short schedule. So the only way we could get them to compete was to move that schedule out a little bit so they can at least put it into the queue and bid on it. The good sign is they're asking us questions on this multi-year competitive bid. And one other thing we do, one of our requirements, is they have to come here and test their buses in our streets. And one of the big manufacturers has come and done that. So that's a very good sign that we're trying to work with them and give them enough opportunity to bid, you know, and take everything that we've learned from the last one to take that out of there, even with the types of buses. Some manufacturers don't build a 60-foot articulated bus, so we made it so they don't get kicked out if they don't make that bus. So we're doing all these different things. It just takes a little bit of time. We just got to give them a little bit of room to bid on it. And this is the best way we could come up with to do it.
Right. Okay. So if you, we'll vote for this, but if you can give me the something in writing that indicates that you inquired of these companies 18 months ago when there was no competition and you had some kind of a briefing and they said, well, we have too much of a backlog. I want to see something, if you have it, that's current, that says 18 months later we called these folks and they said, yep, we're still hopelessly backlogged. But if you, I guess, did something like a four-year procurement, we might be interested. If you have something that verifies those conversations, I'd be interested in taking a look at it because I still am somewhat amazed that these items could be so heavily oversubscribed. But if what you say is true,
it's understood. Believe it. We're not the only trans agency going through this. You know, other trans agencies are going through the exact same thing because they're getting these single vendor bids.
Yeah.
So we're trying to find a way to, you know.
But is there an interstate cooperative purchasing agreement?
You're not allowed to anymore by the federal government.
No, federal government.
They're not allowed anymore?
The federal government.
Yes, it used to be the Minnesota. I think it was Minnesota contract, right?
It was a piggyback option.
And it used to be a piggyback option. And then people would Minnesota would bid out a whole bunch of buses, basically, if you will, save them in a queue. And then other bus transit industries throughout the country could bid on that contract if Minnesota wasn't using all the buses, which they weren't because they overordered on purpose. The federal government caught on to that and stopped that practice about 3 years ago. I was still at Hartford Transit when I learned of it because I did do a piggyback from West Virginia on a bus order that I did for Hartford County. So I learned these same things, but the queues are very difficult. So what I would say, Mr. Comptroller, is that, you know, the first bus order was very early in this administration, very early. So, you know, we just had to make a decision to do it. The second one, what we recognized is that our procurement agents weren't looking far enough out. And so we got caught in this gap situation, if you will. So what we are doing is putting a process in place to get the most competition, because that's what we've heard from the board. We want the most competition. So we're putting a new process in place that we're not going to do this again 18 months from now. We're looking 3 and 4 years out. The procurement that we're going to have now, the RFP, the new RFP, is going to be a 3-year RFP with two 1-year options. And we're doing that so that in year 3, not in year 5 or 4, but in year 3, we will then look again and then put the next one out further. And what we're trying to do is smooth out, because our buses are only good for about 12 years, we're trying to smooth out that procurement process, one, because of the queue, but also for maintenance reasons and new bus reasons. We don't want these big spikes and then the low dips. So we're trying to smooth this process out. So we're trying to accomplish a lot of different things the way that we, in this administration, are looking forward with these procurements.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. Thank you so much.
We read that there may be a secular change. People don't want to drive as much. This is what we read. I don't know if it's true or not. Don't want to drive as much. Rail is getting very expensive, heavy rail, even light rail. And so there is a turn, as with in Baltimore right now, a turn to buses for more than there had been before and at an increasing rate. Is it that there simply isn't enough capacity in the industry to meet the need?
There's
so
absolutely not
why?
Enough capacity. And then the other thing
why,
was
why aren't they expanding? Or do,
so
what is
so the, so it's, the trick is all about funding. So ERA, you remember the ERA funding. So what occurred during ERA when the federal government infused and basically changed the market, if you will, of bus purchases, everybody and their brother purchased buses. So what the manufacturers did is they ramped up, increased the numbers of people or shifts in their plants to accommodate that need. So then there was a glut of buses. After that glut occurred, everybody had to lay off their drivers. They had to go back to single shifts. And so there
but
was
if you
a,
know that 12 years is not a long lifespan.
It is not, but because these buses are in some of the worst road situations, if you can imagine.
Well, no, but I'm saying the ERA was 7-8 years
seven,
ago.
7-8 years, right.
So but they should be preparing
it's
for
starting
the next
to come back. It's starting to come back. But what you're seeing is, like us, we're trying to smooth that curve back out again.
Right.
Instead of having that big.
Now, I get
pump
what you're doing.
Then,
it makes a lot of sense. What I don't understand is why, unless it's just there's no profit at all, why the industry isn't responding more.
It's
supply and demand.
Well, you've got to understand, too, that because there's capital money and there's federal involved, there's a lot of federal guidelines. So we're under different rules than like an over-the-road coach. They can buy a lot of different things. We have a lot of ADA requirements. We have a lot of regulations we have to abide by. That's why we're down to like one engine manufacturer.
But we don't have requirements that other transit authorities don't have.
No, that's why they're all going through the same issue.
Yeah, so
right, that's why we're down to
that. But what she's talking about more is the industry itself. Yeah. The industry is not expanding to meet this demand.
When it sounds like the demand is not a temporary one.
Yeah, so, but it could be that they're looking at it up and down cycle.
Well, it's sort of the same thing we have with car manufacturers, and there's three or four car manufacturers, and even though demand is higher and we're going 2 billion more miles, vehicle miles traveled, they're not expanding because you have this according type function within the market, so they don't want to keep going up and down.
I guess the answer is there really is not a secular change.
There's not.
I'm not sure I believe that. But we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, while you're up there, Mr. Link, can you give us an update on the progress of the introduction of Baltimore Link?
Sure. So, you know, as you know, we on Sunday morning at 3 a.m. launched Baltimore Link and are, you know, kind of reimagining a Baltimore's transit system. And it's going pretty well so far. You know, we're hearing some positive things from our operators as well as our riders about the introduction of new high-frequency service. Great new lines that are operating at, you know, 10 minutes during peak hours. We're working out a couple tweaks, you know, as things happen, you know.
Right.
We're working out a couple tweaks, but all in all, getting pretty positive comments. We focused a lot on public outreach. You know, change is hard. Change is hard for people. And so a lot of this has been about helping people through that change. One great thing we were able to rely on were the great number of Maryland Department of Transportation business units, so drawing volunteers from State Highway Administration, MVA, the others. We've really got a great team of around 300 volunteers from the MDOT family, which has been a fantastic help.
Ambassadors, we call them.
Yeah, the transit ambassadors.
Welcome with people on the streets.
Yep.
Well, that's good. And you had some 200 public meetings as well, as I understand.
Yeah, yeah. So the last 18 months has been spent doing, you know, a lot of nights away. My wife's not so happy. So, you know, a lot of nights away, but, you know, going out, informing the public, listening to comments, incorporating their comments in the final plan, trying to be open and transparent with this planning process.
Okay. I hate to be facetious, but didn't you recently run for Congress in Georgia?
Right, look, wrong guy.
I drove up here just this morning.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for all the work that you've been doing.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I grew up riding the bus almost every day in what was the old DC Transit. It eventually became Metro Bus. They didn't call it Metro because there was no Metro Rail. Put the tokens in the little thing. So I grew up riding the bus. So. All right. Any other questions on transportation agenda? Okay,
I would note for Deputy Secretary Ports that on Friday night at the state's favorite entertainment venue, Meriwether Post Pavilion, none other than Peter Frampton is appearing.
When?
He will be there.
With the Steve Miller Band at the Meriwether Post Pavilion.
All right.
I should check my schedule.
Can we get our
pink
lighters out?
I want to see the wig.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so we're all in favor. So thank you. Okay, Department of General Services.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Ellington Churchill, Secretary for General Services. The department has 15 items on our agenda today, and we have representatives to answer any questions.
Any questions on that?
I have a question.
Yes.
Anyone else?
Yes.
Item 8, Mr. Secretary.
Item 8 concerning Hilltop Development Association, Department of Transportation, Robert Suit with Office of Real Estate.
Mm-hmm. Good morning. Robert Suit. I'm the Chief Lease Management and Procurement for the Office of Real Estate.
Yeah, and I love the idea of an MVA facility in Park Heights. But I just want to make sure we're getting the best deal. I agreed to exercise the extension of the current lease. The landlord has agreed to provide the current lower rent for an additional 14 months. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And have you assessed comparable rents in the area to determine how the extension fits into the current market conditions? Are we getting a better deal than the market? Just about a market-based deal? Or?
Well, bear in mind, with this particular location, we're not only talking about leasing the facility, but also the acreage, because his services include the test driving courses, and he performs the maintenance and the janitorial in the facility. With that in mind, I believe we are getting this market.
Excellent. Well, I'm delighted that you're providing those services up there in that area, and I certainly support what you're doing. But if I could, having visited it many times, frankly, what the area needs is a library. I don't mean to, multitask you here, but we need a library in Park Heights. I think we should name it for my friend George Mitchell, who happens to be a passionate advocate and community leader in Park Heights, who's been working tirelessly to get a library and training center for his community. And someday I hope that his dream becomes a reality. And when it does, it will be because of the dedication and unwavering efforts of George Mitchell and Sandy Rosenberg, I think, who used to go to the original Park Heights Library, which is no longer there. But they desperately need a library. And I hope folks listening to this will think of George Mitchell and try to help him out in his effort. But thank you for giving me the soapbox. And thank you for providing that service up there. It's obviously very crucial.
One question. Thank you. Question for the secretary. And I know we've talked about issue of a blanket purchase agreement for Narcan that's been in the news recently, that the city health commissioner has been concerned that the city may run out of its supply. And what we're working on now through Department of General Services is a statewide contract to purchase, allow the locals, to allow Baltimore City's health department to purchase through the statewide contract, hopefully to get better pricing. And that should allow them to address that particular challenge. One of the reasons that the the supply of Narcan is going through, for several reasons, but one in particular that it's we're running through those supplies so quickly, is the introduction of fentanyl. And with fentanyl, an overdose of fentanyl, it in most cases requires multiple applications of Narcan. And so with if it's just heroin, but we're now in this new world, it may be one application, but if there's fentanyl mixed in, it could be two or more. And so they're running through this too quickly. And so, unfortunately, we have this problem that we have to deal with, not only in Maryland, but statewide, and we've been working to address that challenge. So thank you for working on that contract, and hopefully we can get something out pretty soon.
Thank you, Governor. We know the need is great, and we're working diligently with all the stakeholders to try to make that a reality.
Okay. And then
move approval.
Okay. We're all in favor. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, today.